Welcome to the Religious Studies Project, hosted by David Robertson and myself, Christopher Cotter. This podcast is produced in association with the British Association for the Study of Religions, and you can visit our website at www.religiousstudiesproject.com.
We're here today in London, in the palatial surroundings of the London School of Economics, at the Inform Seminar for Prophecy in the New Millennium. I'm delighted to be joined today by Professor Gordon Melton of Baylor University, who is also founder and director of the Institute for the Study of American Religion. And we're going to be talking today about American millennialism. I guess the best place, or a place to start, would be to start with the Millerites and the Great Disappointment.
Well, William Miller was a Baptist preacher who really has become a phenomenon in American religious history. He begins a new trend in the religious life away from kind of what we think of as post-millennial thinking to pre-millennial thinking. The idea that instead of building the kingdom, we're looking for God to intervene in affairs and establish a kingdom, a new way of life, a new social order. It's quite a phenomenal thing that he did, sitting in his cabin in the winter in rural New York, studying the Bible and biblical chronology and trying to come up with some understanding of what's going to happen in the near future. And of course, what he comes up with is that sometime around 1944, that Christ is dated to return. Mm-hmm. He constructs a set of historical precedents for this, grounded in the Bible, and then punctuated with the events of Christian history to that time. At the same time he's doing this, the Latter-day Saints are having their first organization, their very name, Latter-day Saints. Mm-hmm. They are people attempting to restore what they saw as the true church in the last days of human life, and they are expecting Jesus's soon return. So this provides the context in which this is happening. Once the first date that Miller set doesn't happen, his followers set a second date a year later. That second date is what's generally referred to as the Great Disappointment. Mm-hmm. What's interesting about this is that the Millerite movement, which had drawn people from all various churches that were active in America at that time, probably 40 or 50 different denominations at that point, splits into three movements. They split over what day of the week they're going to worship. Two groups are Sabbatarians. One remains on Sunday. And then the Sabbatarians split over the visions and the prophecies of Ellen G. White, who founds what becomes the Seventh-day Adventist Church. The Sunday worshipers, they called themselves Evangelical Adventists at first, took one course of action. They began to set new dates. 1856, one date in the 1860s, and then 1879. And after each of those dates failed, a group peeled off and formed a new group. And it just said, well, Jesus is coming pretty quickly, but we don't know exactly when. The second group, the Church of God Seventh Day, as it called itself, which would splinter in different groups in the 20th century, they begin to try to revise Miller's original chronology in different ways, okay, but without setting a specific date. Uh-huh. That was their difference. Then Ellen G. White's group chose the other route, and that they said, Well, Jesus actually did come in 44. It's just that he came invisibly, rather than visibly as we thought.
Yeah.
And she took that event as his doing some work in what was called the heavenly sanctuary. And then after he finishes cleansing the heavenly sanctuary, then he'll drop them down and we'll see him.
Okay.
And we don't know how long that's going to take, but shouldn't be very long. That's been the faith of the Seventh-day Adventist. The 79 date of the Sunday worshipers would lead to the Jehovah's Witnesses group.
Okay.
And then they set dates in 1914, 1925, 1945. And then after their 1975 date, they stopped date setting.
Yeah.
And but those have built up a very large body of believers who want to have this expectation that things are going to change, but they've kind of settled in now. I tell people that if you really believe in the second coming, then you don't have a retirement plan and you don't send your kids to college. So that's the way to measure if a person is a real believer.
Do we know what the reasons were for that kind of explosion of premillennial thinking in what, from the middle of the 19th century on?
Well, I think built into Christianity is an understanding that at some point in the future, Christ will return.
Mm-hmm.
The main body of Christians now have vaguely keep that belief. It's in all the statements of faith that they believe Christ will return. But it's been so long that they've figured out that we can't live in the kind of expectation that upsets life. We have to plan for the future as if we're still going to be here.
Mm-hmm.
We do have to educate our children and prepare them for life. And then we have to prepare for the days when we can't work anymore in our retirement. So we have gotten into that kind of process and built a theology to justify it. But the idea is still there, and so every generation has produced a set of people saying it's going to happen in the near future.
Okay.
We are the last generation.
Mm-hmm.
It just so happened that Miller did it with such a sophistication and built such a following that once his prophecy came and went, the community still existed, and the prophecy, the prophetic element was so upfront in the group that it just continually produced new speculation and evangelism, and those communities grew. The Mormons, at the same time, kept that expectation alive for a couple of generations, then they began to lose it. And part of their losing it was the loss of polygamy. It was tied up with the celestial families and the like. And they thoroughly, by the 1950s, had become kingdom builders rather than Latter-day Saints in that sense.
Well, perhaps we could talk a little bit more about then some of these strategies that that these movements use when the prophecies they make fail. I mean, well, Festinger's text is the obvious place to start, isn't it?
Right. One of the things I tell my students is that when you look at all the groups who have given prophecies at various times, they have one thing in common, is that they all failed.
Yeah.
And so for most of us, we look at this is kind of a history of successive groups with failed prophecies.
Mm-hmm.
But for the groups themselves, put bluntly, prophecy never fails.
Yeah, this is an interesting take on it.
Prophecy for them is a part of their life. It happens. And so once the prophecy fails, there are several ways of dealing with it. And the two main ways are to say, well, the prophecy was right, but we got a little detail wrong.
Mm-hmm.
The detail might be the date, and most commonly is the date. So they go back and recalibrate and come up with a new date and project that off in the future. And most often that date is 10 years or more. Mm-hmm. So it gives them some time to absorb what was going on. Eventually what they do is reinterpret the original date in something that includes invisible terms. Mm-hmm. The Jehovah's Witnesses group got started by interpreting the 1879 date as an invisible event. They said, we misunderstood the word parousia in the New Testament. Parousia doesn't mean coming, it means presence. Mm-hmm. So since 79, Christ has been spiritually present among us. And that the real date is 1914, a generation later, 35 years, in which the social order will fall apart. Mm-hmm. And so they get to 1914, and World War I begins. And they thought they really had something. Charles Russell, who founded what we call the Witnesses today, really thought he was at the end of his life, and he was looking at the end of the social order. Mm. And he dies during the war, confident that the war was the sign the social order was falling apart. And then it doesn't, and so they have to go on to other things. And but eventually what has to happen with these groups is they do have to settle down, and they have to find some way of living without this constant immediacy that things are coming to an end. The families have feelings about the next generation, their children. They have to see their children on the way. Mm-hmm. And so they begin to modify the community life in such a way that they can justify planning for the future, for their own retirement and the like. That's one of the things that happens. The easier thing is the spiritualization process of turning the event prophesied into an invisible spiritual event. That's the other big option. I find it actually more prevalent. Mm-hmm. And certainly with most groups who go through two events where they prophesied and then they recalibrated. After they recalibrate, then they spiritualize.
Yeah.
And once they spiritualize, so with the Seventh-day Adventists today, for example, they're building colleges. They're getting research money. They're contributing to social growth. They're selling vegetarianism and the like. So they are slowly settling down for the long haul.
Very this-worldly, isn't it? Yeah.
It's not, and you can see this in the early church. Already in the letters of Paul, he's trying to deal with the expectation of Christ's return, which people thought would be very soon. And he's having to deal with the fact that prominent church members are dying and Christ hasn't returned. What's going to happen to those members?
I was going to ask you about that, actually. You were talking about premillennial, and obviously the other side of that terminology is postmillennial. And it seems to me that they're very similar to the terms that they use in biblical scholarship of imminent eschatology and the realized eschatology.
Right.
And you see, for instance, the kingdom of God, to good one to take, that in the early Gospels, in Mark, for instance, it's something that's literally coming in the lifetime of the readers. Whereas by, certainly by Luke, Matthew it starts, and in Luke it's the kingdom of God is within you. It's something that's already kind of there, but you just have to realize that for yourself.
Yeah, and certainly by the Gospel of John, the realization is there, and you begin to get it. It's really in the second century writings that you see the changes coming. The problem of living with prophecy. You've got these itinerant prophets running around the church, and they're first having to corral these guys, because they're people who actually make a living supplying prophecies of various kinds. But the church over several hundred years realizes that it has to settle in for the long haul. And then certainly by 5th, 6th, 7th century, it's beginning to build cathedrals already settling in for what will be the long haul, setting up structures to evangelize the world, setting up structures to get the community united around the church, and visibly to create communities where the church is in the center of town, and this is going to be the kingdom of God. You get a kind of theology. Postmillennial theology says we're going to build the kingdom and then Christ is going to come. And premillennial theology says, no, we're never going to get there. The next event is Christ comes. And then we'll build the kingdom.
Shall we move a little bit towards the modern day? One of the most iconic, I suppose, instances of American millennialism that most of the people listening will be aware of is the Waco incident, the Branch Davidian compound. How does that compare to these earlier groups?
Well, the Branch Davidians are a Millerite group, actually. They're a splinter of the Seventh-day Adventists. And come about, in part, there are two things that happen in Seventh-day Adventism. Seventh-day Adventism gives up its pacifism. They were pacifists to World War I. And at that point, they give it up, and you begin to get schisms over the pacifism issue. The other issue is the immediacy of prophecy, which begins to die away step by step. So Hutoff, the founder, actually an Eastern European immigrant to America, founds the Branch Davidians and begins to look for more immediate events. At one point in the 50s, a group of them moved to Jerusalem, thinking this is going to happen. And when nothing happens, that leader loses her job, so to speak. What David Koresh was trying to do was to develop a new approach to Hutef's prophecies and give some immediacy to it. He was somewhat paranoid, however, and really expected the world to crash in on him. And when things happened at Waco, he saw that as a kind of a fulfillment of prophecy. The world did come and crash
in. It must be an odd situation to be in to find yourself, you know, this is kind of proving me right, but it's probably also going to be the end of my life.
Well, it really was. Several of the people who tried to mediate that situation got a hold of this. They understood what was happening and had actually cut a deal with Koresh for him to give up. Koresh said, just let me linger long enough to write a few things. But the FBI at that point was already impatient. It was costing them a lot of money to keep up that siege. So they didn't wait it out after the deal had been cut. They'd actually agreed to it. That was the real problem with what went on there. And then the folks inside by that point knew that they could not withstand the forces that were now arrayed against them. What nobody really understood was how much that the building, Mount Carmel, was a fire trap. So in setting up their defenses, they really set themselves up for the disaster that happened.
So it's really the only difference then between, say, these sort of later 20th century millennialistic groups and their 19th century counterparts. Is the difference really only in the media, the way that these events are unfolding in front of the world's eyes?
Well, there's a number of different things that's happening. The media is important because our communication system is so vast now, and our coverage of these events is part of the same thing that we're experiencing otherwise, the 24-hour news cycle.
Yeah.
Where news doesn't happen at 6 o'clock every evening. News happens around the clock. And then the tail wags the dog, because now the news companies have got to fill 24 hours with interesting stuff.
Yeah.
So stuff we would never have heard of a century ago is being heard.
But the, I mean, Waco was literally covered live by the news channels, wasn't it?
Right, and just as the 2012 prophecy is now being covered live, and we're getting kind of blow-by-blow descriptions of what's happening among the New Age people as they prepare for 2012 and how they're talking about it among themselves. The other thing is population growth.
Yeah.
When Miller started his movement, there were only 20 million people in the United States. Now there are 320 million people.
Yeah.
And so we've got all kinds of different prophecies going on at the same time. Evangelicals are listening to Harold Camping do his thing. New Agers are listening to the 2012 stuff. And then there's all kinds of things being handed out on Christian television. Most popular Christian evangelist now is a guy named Hagee from San Antonio, Texas. He's written 20 books on prophecy, and he gets up on television all the time and talking about what's going on as being signs of the time and the like. And he's not the only one. That there's a whole set of prophecies built around the founding of the State of Israel.
Yeah.
With Hal Lindsey's 88 prophecy, and Messianic Judaism was all born out of those kind of dispensational understandings of prophecy. There were a whole set of disappointments that went down with the end of the 1900s and the coming of the year 2000. Cost a lot of people their reputation, and it was amazing how swiftly those got swept under the rug.
Yeah, yeah.
I can remember after 2001, 2002, I was out looking for all the books. They just disappeared quickly, they never showed up in the used book market, and they were rarely on Amazon.
Yeah.
So you just couldn't find the literature that had been there so prominently in the 1990s.
Yeah. Do we expect to see the same sort of thing happening with 2012?
People are saving the 2012 stuff ahead of time.
Yeah.
So their library is now being built up. There's the 1990s produced a group of scholars who are interested in millennialism. So they're now saving that kind of literature.
It's funny though. There's already within that sort of the 2012 milieu efforts to diffuse the fact that that in all likelihood nothing's going to happen.
Well, one of the things that has changed about prophecy is that there are now forces operating actively against it in ways that were not present earlier. Okay. Earlier, you would have a little social derision and what have you. But now there are governments who will actively intervene to suppress millennial groups. I remember the first case was one in the late 90s, or late 80s, early 90s, a Korean group that had come in. I remember I was out in a park one day and somebody passed some tracts to me. Here's this, you know, Christ is coming next week kind of thing. When that group failed, the Korean government stepped in, forced the leader to recant, and disorganized the group.
Wow.
And with Harold Camping, the most recent thing, the evangelical community just got on top of him. And so when his second prophecy failed, they forced him to recant.
Right.
And so you see that kind of activity now. The New Age community had a different kind of thing. Their prophecy was not about a Messiah coming at the end of the order so much as it was that the kingdom will begin to appear. Mm-hmm. This new age of light and love will come and will be visibly present in our life and the like. They gave up on that in the 1990s,
yeah.
And the best-selling books were projecting, well, it's going to be a long time till the kingdom comes, and it's not going to be visible outside our own community.
Yeah. It's not an event, it's an idea. It's one of the... I'm trying to remember the guy from FinTown, the American chap. You know what
I mean. I know who you mean.
I'll edit it in later.
He was one of the people who had first projected the UH vision and then kind of gave up on it.
Yeah, exactly.
What's happening now within the New Age community, or whatever that New Age community has become, is that there are a lot of dissenters to 2012 and vocal dissenters within that community. And so I think after the 2012 thing happens, they'll get back on the road that Redfield and the others had assigned to them back in the 90s. That became a huge community. So you, relatively speaking, while it's small in terms of total population, it's large enough to have even a minority make an impact.
And the difference is, I guess, that being a worldwide community linked by the internet and by, you know, books, and it's because it's so diffuse, that they can be large in number without the need to build sort of physical communities and things the way the Millerites would.
Right, and they're big both in North America and Europe, and so you have a fairly large community that can believe, but at the same time, even larger community that doesn't believe. And we'll go on about it.
Well, I'm glad we got into the in sort of 2012, because I think it would have been remiss of us not to mention that interviewing in 2012. But I think it would be nice to close maybe with how you project this into the future, if you want to make some prophecies about how millennialism is going to go.
Well, I think we're going to continue to see a lot of different predictions coming out of each of the community between American evangelicals, Pentecostal community, which is now a global community, the New Age community, and the sectarian Mormonism. You've got large communities that are focused on the end time in some form or another, a coming New Age, the Kingdom of God, whatever they're going to call it. And the population continues to grow, and religion continues to grow. One would expect that there will continue to be a prophecies. They are fillers for slow news days, so we'll continue to hear about them. The media will give them publicity. The internet will be a place that can quickly disseminate the material worldwide. And it appears from the stats that there's a higher belief level in the third world, which is as it should be, because in poorer countries you have a disengagement between reality and what people hope for, reality and what people need and want, so that the number of these prophecies should continue to grow as the population grows.
That's fantastic. Just want to say, Professor Melton, thank you very much for talking to us today.
It's been my pleasure.
Thank you.
You've just been listening to David speaking with Gordon Melton about American millennialism. That was the first interview that you've heard David do for a while. It's been me, Chris, doing them for quite some time. So I'm pleased to say that we've had another one there from David. And I'm also a bit out of practice at doing these outros, so we'll see how I do. Next week, we've got two... very exciting bits of news for you. First off, we have an interview with Wouter Hanegraaff on Western esotericism, and he is, you know, basically one of the, if not the name that people would think of when Western esotericism is mentioned. Certainly he is one of the top international scholars in that field, and esotericism isn't a subject that we have touched on yet, but you will have noticed a couple of our conference reports by Venetia Robertson focusing upon those issues connected to that. So we're delighted to have that interview. The other bit of news is that we actually have a new interviewer he joined the team a while back, but this is the first time you're going to hear from him. I'll not say too much about him, but we're just very pleased to welcome Knut Melvær, and I do hope I've pronounced your name appropriately, Knut. Knut is at the University of Bergen, and he was attending the EASR conference in Stockholm and has recorded a couple of interviews for us from there, and hopefully we'll be getting some more in the future. So he joins the current interviewing team of myself, David, and Jonathan Tuckett, who you hopefully have heard from as well. And we're very pleased to be expanding beyond the UK and getting someone in Norway involved as well. As per usual, we will publish response essays to these podcasts on the website. We've got our Opportunities Digest, which comes out on Fridays and which is now in PDF form. And there's a lot of lively discussion which goes on our Facebook page, on our Twitter feed, and indeed, hopefully, in the comments section on the website. That's all I've got to say to you for now. You know what's happening next week, so I'm going to sign off and say, as usual, do rate us on iTunes, and thanks for listening.